Caravan from March, Mississippi had, you know, that on there. And so we wear those, you know, in solidarity with the 68 campaign and with the Bible. So that was taken, and all of our, you know, religious collars and vestments were removed. The prayer, Jewish prayer shawls that someone was wearing were removed. And folks got some of them back yesterday. I'm still waiting to get the stole back.
You were held overnight, cockroaches in your cells?
Yeah, I mean, just like lots of poor people experience all across this country every day, we were held, you know, with cockroaches, with very little food.
And when you were brought before the judge, you were put in leg irons?
Well, so we were shackled actually in leg irons all day, you know, which is, you know, the treatment that folks get, poor people get, across this country on a regular basis. And, you know, I think it just ties into why we need a poor people's campaign, why we need to stand up, and declare that we need the rights, to living wages and to
Reverend
housing,
Dr. Liz Theo Harris, we have to leave it there. Co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign, National Call for Moral Revival, a major, rally in Washington on June 23rd. Special thanks to Sam Alkoff, Carla Wills, Chris Belcher, and our news director, Mike Burke. I'm Amy Goodman.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Iran Forum, U.S. Withdrawal from Nuclear Agreement and Path to War, on Friday, June 29th at 6:30 at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. The Iran Forum will feature Jamal Abdi, Executive Director of the National Iran American Council, journalist Reese Ehrlich, and local speakers in a discussion about withdrawing from the Iran nuclear deal. The sponsoring groups are involved in prevention of war and in supporting diplomacy and friendship with the people of Iran. Again, that's the Iran Forum U.S. Withdrawal from the Nuclear Agreement and Path to War on Friday, June 29th at 6:30 at the First Unitarian Church, 1211 Southwest Main Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Join KBOO and Kofallen Cultural Center on Thursday, June 14th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater for an evening of storytelling, live music, and film. Malian artist, author, and storyteller Baba Wage Jakite starts with a talk on the background of the Empire of Mali and the role of West Africa's oral historians before the screening of Keita, Heritage of the Griots, a film which blends modern events with magical realism, mythology, and history. Again, that's an evening of the culture of Mali, including the screening of the film Keita, Heritage of the Griots, on Thursday, June 14th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is Judy Berry from Earth First, and when I'm in Portland, I listen to non-commercial community radio, KBOO Portland, no compromise in defense of the truth.
Create company you work for, they build the past, it just can't last. It's obsolete by design. They send you out rerouting history to make the same old mistakes in a brand new way. Come out from undercover, Holly, Holly and free. Come out wherever you are. And virgin places don't mean a thing to people who never bring their hearts along. And fools like them never fall at all. They're tough as sin, let nobody in. They turn and spin your wheels. Nobody wins. Coincidence and likely stars, they dog your trail like a pack of lies.
And good morning with the strains of Buffy St. Marie from her 1992 Coincidence and Likely Stories. It's the track Disinformation opens up today's Wednesday talk radio, and it is the second Wednesday of the month, and as usual, we have Jacqueline Keeler, not in the studio, but on the line with us this morning. Good morning, Jacqueline.
Good morning, Paul.
How are you doing this morning?
Good, good.
So, okay, Jacqueline Keeler, I haven't introduced you yet, is a Diné Ihanc Tonwan Dakota writer and activist who has contributed to High Country News, The Nation, Yes Magazine, and many other publications. Her books include Edge of the Morning, Native Voices Speak for the Bear's Ears, and Standing Rock to the Standoff, Standing Rock, the Bundy Movement, and the American Story of Occupation, Sovereignty, and the Fight for Sacred Lands. Well, where's that book at currently, the Standing Rock book?
It's supposed to come out in March, but you can actually pre-order it on Amazon already.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I'm finishing the manuscript right now.
Okay. Well, look for that soon, and I'm sure we'll have you on to talk more about that when, in fact, it does come out in actual paper form and electronic form. And so you just got back not too long ago from North Dakota again, right?
No, actually, I'm going in a couple of weeks. I'm actually going to North Dakota to attend Red Vaughn Phantom Singh, Red Vaughn Ballast. She's a water protector, Lakota woman who is had to do a plea deal. She was the one who was wrestled to the ground by at Standing Rock on the front lines by all those police officers in riot gear and accused of having a gun. And so so they're going to be sentencing her on June 25th. Originally it was in May, but they rescheduled it. So I'm going out.
That's where my confusion. I'll have to correct that on my program page. I apologize for that. But there has been other news about the water protectors before we get into other subjects that I know you wanted to talk about. Little Feather was just sentenced. Is that right?
Yes, Little Feather. He's also a water protector, and he was sentenced. Actually, his sentencing was that week that Red Vaughn was supposed to be, which was on May 30th, so he was sentenced to 3 years in prison. It was a federal case. He was a federal defendant, and so he had already been held for over a year and a half. So he also got credit for time served. So he's hopefully he'll be out in a year or so, and they might actually move him down to New Mexico where his family is. So I've been in contact with I'm working on a story for High Country News, which will feature a number of the federal defendants, including Little Feather and Red Vaughn. And so that's why I'll be traveling back to North Dakota in a couple of weeks.
So 3 years, that's a pretty hefty sentence. What was he actually sentenced on the basis of?
Let me see. was accused of starting a fire on the front lines. I don't think that there's any he had a previous record, and you could read more about it on, they have a website, freelittlefeather.com.
Okay.
It's part of the difficulties. Like, normally when people do actions, people who have previous felonies, aren't put on the front lines. But in this case, people felt very passionate about it, and this gave his life a lot of meaning. He's a Chumash Indian from California, and had a very troubled life, and going to Standing Rock really brought, a lot of positivity into his life, and really helped him and give him a community. And with Red Fawn as well, she has a previous conviction, which is a drug conviction in Colorado, and so this is why their cases are why they were felony cases, and also why they had to do a plea deal.
Mm-hmm. One more thing regarding Standing Rock, which seems amazing that it's now about 2 years ago. So a judge in North Dakota dismissed a complaint that North Dakota regulators filed against a North Carolina-based company that handled security for the developer of the Dakota Access Pipeline. Of course, people remember Tiger Swan and the dogs and everything. So that's another piece of news, another defeat in this lingering fallout from the Standing Rock case. And I guess the North Dakota's Private Investigative and Security Board tried to basically prevent Tiger Swan from continuing to do any work in North Dakota, and sued Tiger Swan anyway. So that just happened at the end of May as well.
It actually happened the same day that Little Feather was sentenced.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So, there has been very little accountability, and certainly I think this reflects the nature. One of the things I'm actually writing about in my book is the nature of states. I think sometimes we forget that states are the creation, the aftermath of the taking of land, right? They don't exist as some sort of innocence or some sort of, like they've always been here. A state like North Dakota, and even a state like Oregon, has its origins in a taking of the land and an occupation of it, a military occupation. This is why we have so many places called Fort This and That, and certainly the military occupation is ongoing. When you look at what happened at Standing Rock, that area where the pipeline was north of the reservation boundary is actually unceded treaty land and is illegally occupied by the U.S. government and by the state of North Dakota. And even if you've been illegally occupying something and breaking international law for 160 years, it doesn't put you in the right. And so the military response, the heavy military response by the state of North Dakota and the consistent refusal to be accountable for that in the courts and otherwise, even by actors like Tiger Swan, it really demonstrates the nature of the occupation and the actual what it really means, what states really are. They're a continued occupational government over Indian land.
And which leads pretty directly into one of the subjects you did want to talk about, which is your recent Bedrock lecture on human rights and climate change, called The Real Cost of the Bakken on Native Communities. Speaking of forts, there's actually a fort in the name of the Fort Berthold Indian Reservation in the Bakken region of North Dakota. So when did you give this talk, and what was it about?
Well, I actually, I was asked, Oregon State University did this series and invited a number of people to speak. It's called the Bedrock Lectures on Human Rights and Climate Change. And other speakers include Winona LaDuke, Bill McKibben, Josh Fox, who I can think of on the top of my head. So I spoke on this issue of the real costs of the Bakken on Native communities, and I put it in particularly in context of the price that Native women pay and continue to pay in these extractive industries and the man camps and the violence, how the violence to the land is reflected in the violence on our bodies. And so I had published last month, I think, an article about Olivia Lone Bear, the search for Olivia Lone Bear in High Country News. And she's from the Fort Berthold Reservation, and that's where she went missing over 7 months ago now. And her family are still searching for her. They have no leads whatsoever at this point. And the reservation is over 1 million acres. It's square in the middle of the Bakken. It's almost 30% of the oil, that the fracked oil that is pumped out of the Bakken comes from their reservation. And she, her life was shaped by that sort of Wild West environment that creates. I was pretty surprised when I went there and talked to women, and many of them live very circumscribed lives because it's because of the nature, you can't go out at night, you can't do a lot of things that most American women take for granted because of the violence against women that is there.
So are there, do you have have at hand any statistics? Is it really dramatically higher, the violence?
The thing is, the statistics are not good, mm-hmm. Both in outcomes and in quality of the actual statistics. The stats that are normally cited are from a Department of Justice report from 2010, which lists a lot of data that was available, particularly reported data. And what it found was that that Native women have 2.5 times the rate of rape and murder of other women in the country, other American women. And in some counties, actually 9 times the rate of murder. And really difficult stats. And the other thing that's sort of controversial in this reported data is that Native women experience violence, rape, and murder. Most of the perpetrators are white men, like 70%. And there's been some debate over that particular figure, and it's actually very unusual. Every other woman in the country is basically murdered and raped by men of her own race or ethnic group. Right, the majority, 70, it's the exact flip opposite, and so this is that white men are still the major perpetuators of violence against Native women, according to this data, it says something about the continued violence of colonialism and how Native women experience it on our bodies.
And you're talking specifically about the Bakken region. And people talk about, these man camps, these sort of temporary facilities where men are congregated in trailers or temporary house, some form of temporary housing, to service these extractive industries. Sounds like the gold rush days, the logging camps. This has a long history in America in any colonial context, but in particular, I was thinking of is it known or is there any figures kept about the violence specifically against women and specifically Native women around those communities, those temporary communities?
Yeah, they're trying to, a number of laws the data collection is not good for Native women in general. It's not good. There is no sharing of data. There is no sharing information that's really going on in a consistent manner. This is the problem. And so you have Senator Heidi Heitkamp from North Dakota recently proposed a law. It's called Savannah's Act. It's in honor of Savannah Graywind, a young Native woman who was murdered just recently in the past year and a half, I think, she was murdered, and she was heavily pregnant, and her neighbor, a white woman, had her come over to her apartment, and then she murdered her and cut her baby out of her and stole the baby. It's just a horrific, horrific thing. And so this was Savannah's Act. Part of that does include better reporting and coordination of data. There's very little of this that goes on right now, so we don't have good numbers. Often they won't mark the race. Often it's very, as I note in the article, it's very hard to get the police to even address these as crimes. The name of the article I wrote was "No Crime Scene," because this is what the Olivia Lone Bear's family was told, was that they could not file a missing persons report because there was, quote, no crime scene. Right? This is not true. You don't need a crime scene to report a loved one missing. And but they were given the runaround by the police. And often, and I've heard this over and over again from different families, and that the law enforcement is unresponsive and is actually hostile to even regarding or documenting these things. And so it's so data is bad. Data is very bad. The state of Washington recently passed a law also to address the issue of data collection. And I'd heard talking to Deborah Denton, who runs the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women USA group that's actually based here in Portland, that when she was in Arizona, that the Arizona officials demanded, they listed every Native woman who was murdered as white, because they demanded that you had to bring in a CIB, a Certificate of Indian Blood, a federal document documenting how much Indian blood a person has, and before they would change the race to Native. Yeah.
Pretty grim.
So data is bad. It's just terrible.
So you can keep talking about this issue. I wanted to bring in another current thing regarding, unfortunately, President Trump. This sort of the deeper context here. I'm sure you caught the address he gave at the Naval Academy in Annapolis, Maryland, where he made some statements. In recent years and even decades, too many people have forgotten the truth. There's nothing Americans can't do, absolutely nothing. In recent years and even decades, too many people have forgotten that truth. They have forgotten that our ancestors trounced an empire, tamed a continent, and triumphed over the worst evils in history. And, you know, it's easy to kind of get all riled up about such a statement, and of course we should, but, you know, the deeper context is that, certainly many European Americans either think that way explicitly, or it sort of forms the backdrop of our worldview in general. Would you agree with that?
Oh yeah, definitely. And even for a family like Trump's, whose family are recent immigrants to this country, like within the last 100 years, you know, he still views the entire history of this country as belonging to him. You know, his mother wasn't born in this country, and his grandparents only came in the 1900s. You know, because he's white, he views that victory as part of his victory, even though his family were not here.
That's interesting. I know you've pointed that out in the past, but our ancestors trounced an empire. It's part of his general grandiosity.
His grandfather was German, avoided the draft in it was a small German principality, and then went to the gold rush in Alaska in the late 19th century, then returned to his home in Germany and married, and then he tried to live there, but they deported him because he had dodged the draft, deported him back to the United States, and then that's when they moved to New York City, and that was in the 20th century. I mean, his family are recent immigrants to this country. They're not, they have not been here a very long time.
So I got that information. I mean, it's widely reported that in many news sources, but I got it in particular from your fellow tribes Congressman Mark Charles, Dene Navajo, from a Native News Online article, which I cite in on my program page, "When Your President Motivates Military Graduates by Celebrating the Genocide of Native Peoples." It's quite a good article, worth checking out.
Yeah, I think in my lecture, the real cost of the Bakken on Native communities, which is on YouTube. You can, I think, the link is on the site there. On KBU. I really look at the history of how the land was taken and what it means to pursue extractive economies on the land as a colonial business model, and versus that which comes from being an indigenous people. And I think I've said this on the show before, but my definition of a people, of this is what most Native people call ourselves, the people, right? The real people. Dene Navajo. Navajos call themselves Dene, and that means the people, Dene. And the definition of that, really, I had to come up with something to counter the definition of a colonist, which is what I regard most Americans as being, are colonists. And which most people know the definition of colonialism, which is where you go to someone else's homeland, you then begin to redirect the wealth to your own ruling class and send it home, right? That's the whole definition of colonialism. And but for real people, the definition really lies in a origin story that begins with the meeting with a sacred being who is a manifestation of the land itself. And when I say land, I don't mean the entire planet. I mean a specific place on earth, right? So for my father's people, for the Dakota Lakota people, that would be the Great Plains, right? And the meeting with the white buffalo calf woman, who was a manifestation of the Great Plains and of the Buffalo Nation, the Tatanka Oyatewa. And for my mother's people, of course, that's the Southwest. That's the area between the four sacred mountains, the Dineta, the Dinetakea. And then with that meeting, you are given instructions on how to live on the land and what the rules are and how you are going to live with all the other peoples there. And those would be all the four-legged, all the peoples that already live there, what your relationship is, what you can and cannot do, right? And what your responsibilities are. And this is what makes you a people, is this agreement that you've made with the land. And what I point out in my lecture is that extractive economies, as pursued on the Fort Berthold Reservation, are, there's a point in which they are in direct conflict with that identity as people, right? On Fort Berthold, you have three tribes that are there. You have the Mandan, the Arikara, and the Hidatsa, right? And they are distinct peoples. They're not all one people. They're becoming more so because they've intermarried quite a bit. But there's a point at which that threatens those identities, because when you are engaging in an extractive industry, and it's one thing for a multinational corporation to do that, because they can go from place to place to place. They're not tied. They don't have that agreement to any particular place on earth, right? This agreement of respect. And when I was interviewing folks on the Fort Berthold Reservation, something that came up was the way in which their homeland was being ruined by this by fracking, and they were hoping that their tribe had was saving enough money in order to buy them a new reservation. So this is a thing of disposability, where the land is viewed as disposable, and then you move on, you keep moving on, and so this is in which the people then become disposable, and all the peoples that live in that land, and so I think that this is sort of what I was getting at. It's the video is about, the lecture is about 20 minutes long, but it's it was interesting to put that lecture together.
Mm-hmm. And this is Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm your host, Paul Rowland. I have my regular second Wednesday co-host on the phone with us, Jacqueline Keeler. She's a Dene a Dakota writer and activist. And her new book, Standing Rock to the Standoff, Standing Rock to the Bundy Movement, and the American Story of Occupation, Sovereignty, and the Fight for Sacred Lands, will be coming out. And stay tuned for that. This is a call-in show. I kind of waited longer than usual to let people know that. Of course, most of my regular listeners know that already. 503-231-8187. If you want to engage in this conversation, 503-231-8187. I don't know if there's other things you want to talk about. I just want to mention briefly and get your response to this. The Trump administration's Health and Human Services Department announced that Native Americans would not be exempt from state-mandated Medicaid work requirements. This is another article from Native News Online by Cherokee writer Rebecca Nagel. Headlined, a recent Trump administration ruling attacked the heart of tribal sovereignty. You want to say anything about that?
Yeah, that's Trump, it definitely is, you know, his administration is posing a direct challenge to the sovereignty of Native nations and their continued existence. I mean, ever since he's been elected, we've known that this is a harbinger of another termination era. The Termination Act was passed by Congress in the 1950s, and that was really an era where Congress wanted to terminate tribes and get rid of them, you know, completely make them disappear politically off the face of the earth. And it was actually Nixon in 1970 who basically got rid of that policy and replaced it with a focus on sovereignty. And now with the Trump administration, we're seeing them taking steps in many ways to go back to that policy of politically disappearing our indigenous nations.
And let me just read if people haven't heard about that. It says read another few sentences. While the decision could have far-reaching consequences for the funding of Indian health services and the health outcomes of Native people, the cause for alarm goes beyond access to resources. Reportedly, HHS's legal basis for their decision is that Native Americans are a race, not a political group, and therefore cannot receive special race-based treatment. The argument, as it stands, attacks the heart of tribal sovereignty. I know this is something you've talked about in various ways on this program and elsewhere. This issue that Native Americans are a race, not a political group.
Yeah, that's why I say our strongest defense is our political identity. That is what has always been under attack, is our political existence as nations, because it is as nations that we have claims to the land, not as individuals. So as long as they can turn us into individuals, then they can politically, you know, break us up and make us no longer a threat to land claims, right? And I don't know if you've there's a map. There's a great map that shows how much of U.S. land actually would not stand up under any kind of international scrutiny. And one of the things I always point out is that the treating process, definitely the fact that we signed treaties with the U.S. government, the Great Sioux Nation signed, of course, the Fort Laramie treaties and many other treaties, and the Navajo Nation also signed a treaty. And these treaties, of course, were ratified by the Senate, and they are international law, right? And only sovereign nations can enter into treaties under international law. There's no one else can do that. So certainly Native nations were signing treaties with countries before the U.S. even existed, right? And in fact, the first treaty that the United States government signed was with a Native nation. And I think it was with the Cherokee Nation, and the Cherokee already had treaties, actually had a stronger international political standing than the United States did, because at that point the United States was not formally recognized by any other foreign government, right? Mm-hmm. And so it was a rogue state; no one had recognized it, and so a Native nation signing a treaty with it was a political stepping stone to that international recognition, right? So you know, so this attempt to turn us into a race and to strip us of our citizenship is really incumbent on that sort of ignorance, American ignorance of the political nature of our nations and the existence of our nations as nations. Our sovereignty is basically suppressed by the United States. It's not gone. It's suppressed, actively suppressed. There are Native nations that exert their sovereignty in different ways. My husband's the Six Iroquois Confederacy, they issue their own passports, right? And the Iroquois, the lacrosse team, which plays internationally and every year is third or fourth in the world in lacrosse, the Iroquois nationals, they travel, the entire team travels on Iroquois passports. Mm-hmm. And so the exertion of our sovereignty and the occupation by a colonial government, both in the United States and Canada, you know, is something that I think that Americans, particularly Americans who consider themselves a progressive force in the world, need to really much more honestly deal with, contend with, of their very identity is that of a colonist.
And I think that these issues that this article and this issue brings up, really, in my experience, as an adult, an active, politically active and aware adult, especially since I got involved in treaty rights and other Native American support issues, is that most politically active, progressive, even many radical people don't really get these issues. There's a lot of confusion. So I think this is a really good moment, opportunity to educate ourselves in that. Read this article, which I again leaked to, a recent Trump administration ruling attacked the heart of tribal sovereignty. And I want to read just one more paragraph, if you'll allow me. But before I do that, it's 8:36. Time is flying by. So if you do want to call in and engage with Jacqueline Keeler for the next 20 minutes, you better do so now, because you won't have much time at the end. So 503-231-8187. Okay, let me just read this. This is really key. It's a lot to tease out here. So people should really get this article and others like it and really educate themselves. Yet, first she talks about the sovereignty of tribal nations predating the creation of the U.S., like you just said, and it being treaties being the supreme law of the land. And they say states do not have the authority to pass policies that violate these treaties, such as denying Native Americans access to health care because they don't have a job. Yet, Health and Human Services is claiming that granting Native Americans treaty-based health care access raises, quote, civil rights concerns. The Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment states that no citizen shall be denied equal protection of the laws. While the clause has been essential to civil rights victories like Brown versus Board of Education, it has also been used to fight progressive measures like affirmative action in Fisher versus University of Texas. When it comes to federal Indian law, the Equal Protection Clause has been twisted by anti-Indian groups to attack tribal sovereignty. Today, the most prominent example comes from the Goldwater Institute, a conservative think tank based out of Arizona, that is working to have the Indian Child Welfare Act, ICWA, declared unconstitutional. When ICWA was passed in 1978 to keep Native children with Native families, Congress admitted that 25% to 35% of all Native children had been adopted out. But according to Goldwater's website, ICWA's, quote, denial of equal protection is unfair to Native children, and the Supreme Court should, quote, agree that this codification of substandard treatment should not stand. It seems like these are harbingers of many, many more assaults to come, it looks like.
So I wrote extensively on ICWA and the conservative sort of a conservative touch point where they're trying to really use the Indian Child Welfare Act to dismantle sovereignty. And I wrote about that extensively when I covered the Baby Veronica case back in 2013. And you can just Google my name, Baby Veronica Keeler, a lot of articles will come up. And I wrote an article after Baby Veronica was a Cherokee child who was basically sold as an infant by her white mother while her Cherokee father was deployed overseas, I think in Afghanistan. and to a white couple in South Carolina. And they were, she was in Oklahoma, so about 1,000 miles away. And so the Cherokee family under ICWA has, the tribe has a right to the child, right? And this is really, I think you have to put a national scope on this, in the sense of this, that this is the Cherokee Nation. Every nation, under particularly under the Geneva Convention on genocide, right? Every nation has a right to their children. No country in this world would allow people to take their children. You know, the idea that you could take a child from France and the French government have no say about it is completely ridiculous. And this is why the political lens is so important for understanding who Native people are. We're not just an ethnic group. We're not a race, right? We're in our tribes are multiracial, you know? We have tribal members who look black, you know, as Trump was, you know, saying in the 90s at a congressional hearing, and, disparaging a tribe because they looked black to him. They didn't look Indian to him. You know, they look white. They look like many different races, right? We are nations, okay? We have citizens. We are not a race. And the Baby Veronica case went to the Supreme Court, and really, you know, Sonia Sotomayor had a very difficult time explaining to the other justices that this was not a blood quantum issue, right? That it was not her blood quantum matter, it was her citizenship in the Cherokee Nation. And the Cherokee Nation doesn't have blood quantum. And so it's, and the same way the United States doesn't have blood quantum. Your citizenship in the U.S. is not contingent on how much Revolutionary War blood you have. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's kind of the same thing, you know, where you have an ancestor who was fought in the Revolutionary War, and that's your percentage of real American blood. Right, we don't, you know, not all tribes do that. That's not a thing. In the same way that not all nations have a blood quantum, or what do they call it, a singwa. You know, some of them do have certain regulations. Like in India, you have to have one parent who was a citizen of India. Or in Ireland, you have to have one grandparent who was a citizen of Ireland. You know, not all nations do that. And so the child was taken. The Supreme Court didn't understand the issue. And even Sotomayor said that she did not have any background in Indian federal law because that's not required to pass the bar. Scalia famously said that he didn't know anything about Indian federal law, and he just made up whatever he wanted to be. He didn't even know precedent. Do you know what I mean? And it's a kind of arrogance. And this really points to the need for, when Baby Veronica was taken, and she was actually being, the Cherokee Nation doesn't have a land base anymore, really. And so, but they had a house which they had diplomatic immunity in, a kind of a mansion they own. And they kept the Brown family, Baby Veronica's family, her Cherokee family, in that house to protect them, right, when this was all going on. And then, the South Carolina's governor at the time, Nikki Haley, who is now our U.S. Ambassador to the U.N., right, she actually sent 5 carloads of federal marshals, armed federal marshals, to that Cherokee safe house and took the baby. And the Cherokee grandfather had a heart attack while his grandchild was being taken. And so, you know, the issue of sovereignty is very important. The taking of children, this actually falls under the Geneva Convention on Genocide, because this is something that they do. Ethnic cleansing, you take the children away from an ethnic minority, and then in this way you make that group disappear.
Mm-hmm.
So sovereignty and the political reality of our nations is our greatest defense.
And greatest threat to what the Trumpistas and the neocons, and really the, you know, the corporate America, majority of corporate America, have been heading towards. So let me just read a little bit more. The HHS ruling is not the first time Native advocates have criticized the Trump administration's position on tribal sovereignty. In late 2016, Trump's transition team on Native Americans caused a stir when they proposed privatizing remaining tribal lands. in order to ease the path for oil and other resource extraction. Of course, that's exactly what termination was all about, mainly about...
Yeah, I wrote about that as well when I wrote about the whole Bears Ears reduction thing in December when Trump signed those things. I wrote about it for Yes Magazine, and I wrote about it for a whole bunch of publications. But yeah, the issue of the private is... Zinke and I have been I've been covering him a lot in the past year. And one of the first things he stated and the Trump administration, that was actually that statement about the privatization came up from a number of sources in the Trump administration. It definitely is part of what they want to do. They have done it. The U.S. government has done that before in Alaska, where they turned Alaskan Native communities into corporations. And we definitely don't want that to happen here. Basically, it's very interesting because, I give this whole lecture about how the United States is still a colony. And one of the things that really inspired the lecture was when I was covering the Keystone XL pipeline in 2014. And I was talking to white ranchers and farmers in South Dakota and Nebraska. And they were coming to me and they were completely shocked. They were shocked the U.S. government had given eminent domain to a Canadian company, TransCanada, which is the owner of the Keystone Pipeline. And there was no way they could fight it, because even if they fought it in court, they would lose and they would just be out the money, the legal costs. And I looked at them and I was like, don't you know the origins of this country? And the 13 original colonies, many of them began as corporations, as joint stock companies, some of the earliest forms of modern corporations. And you have the Virginia Company of Adventures from London, which started the Virginia colony, and the Massachusetts Bay Company, of course, the Hudson's Bay, many companies. I definitely, this whole thing of now they want to turn us into corporations, And then our origin story is all about a profit motive and not about a connection to the land itself, right? Because that's what a corporation is based on is profit, and exploitation to feed that profit, and so in a way they're trying to change us into them, and then we're easier to deal with and we're also easier to get rid of.
Let me just continue that paragraph. American Indian reservations comprise of only 2% of all land in the United States, but hold an estimated 20% of oil and gas reserves, 50% of uranium reserves, and 30% of all coal west of the Mississippi. In 2009, the Council of Energy Resource Tribes estimated energy resources on tribal land worth about $1.5 trillion. This is something I didn't know. Ross Swimmer, who was head of Indian Affairs under Reagan, under Bush? I can't remember. Anyway, co-chair of the Trump transition team, is partner of an investment fund with heavy ties to oil, including the company that built the controversial Dakota Access Pipeline, Koch Industries, owned by the Koch brothers, who have funneled money to the Goldwater Institute, which we talked about earlier, through donors' trust, was the fourth largest lobbyist for oil in 2012 and owns 4 oil refineries, 6 ethanol plants, and 4,000 miles of pipeline. If the legal argument that, quote, special protections for Native Americans are unconstitutional was upheld by the courts, tribal lands could use their protected status, making their vast energy reserves open for business. Of course, with the current Supreme Court, that's a very real fear.
Yeah, I think it's, I've widely written on the whole issue of how much of the reserves that we have under the ground, the mineral reserves, are on Indian land and water reserves as well. The issue of water is another big part of it. One of the things that's been happening in the courts is that the tribes have been winning as far as the idea that they are what is the term that's often used? You have to read my articles. I've written all on this, but since it's hard to remember. I've written over 50 articles in the last 3 years, so it's a lot. But that they have the oldest water rights, basically, and therefore they take precedence over other water users. And
grandfathered in. Or?
There's another term for it. I can't. Yeah, you have to read my articles to get
senior water rights. So,
yes, yeah. That's it. Maybe that's a, but anyway, I like her articles. Basically, she's cribbed everything I've written over the last, 50 articles into one article. And this has been this is a challenge. This is something that they want to dismantle. This is also recently a ruling came out in Arizona as well, giving senior water rights to tribes there, and of course a place like Arizona where water is the lack of water threatens the growth, the continued growth, massive growth there in cities like Phoenix, and you can be sure that they're going to fight tooth and nail to make tribes disappear politically so they don't have any rights to the water.
Well, it sounds like we do have finally a caller with 10 minutes to go. Is that Pear?
That's right.
Go ahead, you're on the air.
Yeah. Hey, can somebody become a citizen of a Native nation?
So, I was going to say after baby Veronica was taken, it was this incredibly traumatic event for Indian Country, and also for a lot of adoptees. I was also interviewing a lot of folks who've been adopted out, and they're called lost birds. And I wrote this big piece called what's it called? Baby Veronica, the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington, Indigenous Sovereignty, and in that I talk a lot about what actually it means to be a citizen of a Native nation and what it could mean, And one of the things I really promote is the idea of naturalization, because I think that should be within the right of any sovereign nation. This sort of artificial idea of a race was imposed upon us by the Americans in order to make us disappear, because they knew that with each generation we'd be less pure, because how much can a group intermarry, especially really small tribes? So we've always brought in new people. That's always been the way we've been. We've never been, we're like any other nation. I think that tribes should be able to naturalize people. And it was actually, I think the Cherokee Nation took this to the Supreme Court in the 1830s, and because they were basically naturalizing folks who were marrying into the tribe. And the U.S. is very threatened by this. They don't want their citizens potentially, shifting, particularly then when it was really a question whether they would have dominance over that area. In the southeast, and before the full creation of certain states like Tennessee and such, so I think that it should be within the purview of any tribe to do that, and of course they would set the rules of how that would be, and I think it would also be a good we have people who really want to be us, to assume our identity, right, without any right or any proof. Well, if there was a way they could do that, that would also recognize the sovereignty of the nation, I think that would be a much healthier way of rather than, appropriating our identity or doing, pretending, being a pretendian, they could actually go through a formal process of becoming a citizen. But of course, this sort of thing is a direct threat to the sovereignty of the United States.
Per, did you have any follow-up questions?
Well, yeah, a lot of seems to me a lot more people are dual citizens these days.
Yes, yeah, that would be, I think, something that, I have U.S. citizenship, of course, and I am a citizen of the Navajo Nation as well. Although I can't, because of federal rules, I couldn't enroll in my father's tribe as well. My parents had to choose whether I'd be enrolled on the Navajo Nation or on the Yankton Sioux Reservation tribe. And my husband has status at Six Nations in Canada, the Iroquois Confederacy up there.
Well, thanks for calling. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, I think a lot of people might find that very attractive.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, I think so.
I just want to say one thing, which is that you're talking about the threat early on. I remember, I'm sure it's been in other books, but Facing West, The Metaphysics of Indian Hating and Empire Building by Richard Drennan, had a wonderful early chapter, very powerful, where he talked about Marymount, I believe it was in Massachusetts, you know, there were, there's people who are basically fleeing from the strictures of the Puritans in the Massachusetts Bay Colony and kind of forming their own interracial or whatever community, people of different backgrounds, some Native, some European. And I don't know, you know, whether it was a good thing or a bad thing, but it was seen as a very definite threat. And also that he talks about how there was, you know, when you know, during warfare, colonial warfare, which existed, and where people, you know, were taken captive on both sides, both Native children and European children. Apparently, most of the European children who grew up in the Native cultures didn't want to return, whereas the converse was not true, that Native children taken captive by the Europeans always strove to return to their Native communities. So there is something very attractive about those Native communities and Native life ways that I think is really forms a kind of a psychological bedrock of this country, this awareness of that truth and the need to suppress that truth.
Yeah, I think so. That's this is why this is the sovereignty of Native nations is invisible to most people, even progressive people, Americans today. Really, you know, states have a lower political status than tribes do, actually, because tribes are sovereign nations. So maps really should be drawn to show, to indicate that. Instead, what is done is that, you know, states are drawn in hard lines and tribes are drawn in little faded little sort of things like parks, you know. And in fact, that's completely inaccurate, which is part of what there's just been a concerted disinformation campaign that's been part of U.S. policy for hundreds of years now. And this is why so many Americans are ignorant about the true political nature. And this is why, of course, it's the political nature of who we are that is under attack, and under attack today by the Trump administration. I'm actually posting the Baby Veronica article that I mentioned on my social media. You can find me on Twitter at JF Keeler and on Facebook under Jacqueline Keeler.
And I will I link to those as well on my program page, kboo.fm. Only got a few minutes left. Any other things going on or things coming up you wanna mention?
I recently had the opportunity to speak to the local campfire organization, and it was about their use of cultural appropriation. I guess they made these dresses and that were based on Native women's clothing, and they're trying to find a different. They're having an internal discussion about whether or not they should continue that or not. And so I got to speak to them, and that was pretty interesting. I had no idea they were doing that, and I looked at the images online. I was pretty shocked. And disappointed, I think, definitely. But we had a good conversation, and then of course in a couple of weeks I will be flying out to North Dakota to cover the sentencing of Red Fawn Fallis, and I will be reporting to KBOO on that.
Okay, well, great. Well, that's about all the time we have right now. So thanks again, as always, second Wednesday co-host Jacqueline Keeler. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And that's it for today's show. I'm Paul Rowland with Wednesday Talk Radio.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to present the live broadcast for the 26th annual Good in the Hood Multicultural Music, Arts, and Food Festival. This three-day celebration kicks off Friday, June 22nd, with the Good in the Hood Parade and Festival continuing Saturday, June 23rd, and ending Sunday evening, June 24th. Good in the Hood is back at King School Park at Northeast Grand Avenue. Tune into KBOO starting Saturday afternoon on June 23rd for the live broadcast. More information about Good in the Hood can be found on the KBOO.FM website on the home page.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Northwest Deaf Arts Festival on Saturday, June 16th at Mississippi Studios in Portland. The Northwest Deaf Arts Festival consists of a family-friendly matinee show as well as an adult-only 21 and over evening show. Performers include hip-hop artist Sean Forbes, dancer Antoine Hunter, poet Raymond Luzak, and more. Again, that's the Northwest Deaf Arts Festival on Saturday, June 16th at 2 p.m. and 6 p.m. Mississippi Studios is located at 3939 North Mississippi Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. It's 9 o'clock. You are listening to KBOO Portland. And here's what we have coming up for you this morning on KBOO for the remainder of the morning. First, at coming right up, it's Sojourner Truth Radio. Today, MIT professor Craig Wilder discusses his book, Ebony and Ivy, Race, Slavery, and the Troubled History of America's Universities. At 10 o'clock, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11 o'clock on the Dirtbag, Glenn Andreessen talks all things gardening and takes your calls. We thank you, KBOO members, for your great support out there. You know you tune into KBOO to stay informed about the true issues of the people. You've got to support that community radio station, KBOO. You can go to kboo.fm.